Part 10. Stone Mind. It's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog. Mark Twain. 30. Cliff watched the sleeting, tarnished silver rain slam down from an angry, growling purple cloud. This was like a more ferocious form of the cool autumnal storms he had waited out while hiking in the high Sierra Nevada, with crackling platinum lightning electrifying half the sky's dark pewter. Crack and boom, all louder and larger than in the Sierra, maybe because it came from an atmosphere deeper and more driven, sprawling across scales far larger than planets. This violence was casually enormous, with clouds stacked like purple sandwiches up the silvered sky until they faded in the haze. The stench of wet wood mingled with the zesty tang of ozone, sharp in his nose and sinuses. He tasted iron in the drops that splashed on his outstretched tongue, and salt in the rough leaves they'd just eaten, plus a citrus burn in the vegetables they'd managed to scrounge from some trees nearby before the hammering rainstorm arrived. Tastes of the alien lands.
"Rain near done," Court said. "Need go soon."
Cliff could scarcely believe this prediction. Why?
"Folk find us."
"You're sure?"
"They know much, even stones."
A gesture to distant sharp peaks emerging from cottony clouds as the storm ebbed.
"Speak to them, always know."
A grave nod of Court's bare head said much. Cliff nodded. Rain pattered down and smoke stained the air, and it was hard to think. Court made sense. The whole bowl was deeply wired in some way. Its lands were vast, but not stupid. There had to be a smart network that wove all this together. Still, most of the bowl had to run on its own. No one or no thing could manage so huge a space unless the default options were stable, ordinary, and would work without incessant managing. Still, no security from prying eyes would last for long. Their only advantage was that the bowl was, while well integrated, still so vast. Even light took a while to cross it, up to 12 minutes from the edge of the rim to the other edge. The delays sending text or faint voices across it to Red Wing on Sunseeker were irritating, especially when you could lose contact at any second. The sky roiled with restless, smoldering energy. Sudden gusts of howling wind drove the cold, hard rain into their rock shelter. The pewter sky slid endlessly across them. But Quirt had made them stop here in a long-shaped stone space, angular and ancient-seeming, cut back into a hillside. They got in just before the slamming storm descended. Then after hours of huddling, the sky calmed. By the time they ate some of their food, heating it with burning twigs, a black slate wedge had slid overhead and the first hard drops spattered down. Now it suddenly ended. Cliff turned to the others and said, "Pack up, gang." Sill and humans, they all grunted a bit with the effort of getting moving and splashed water on their fire. Cliff could still taste the sweet meat they had roasted there. It had made him wish for a robust California Zinfandel, though perhaps those didn't even exist anymore now. Maybe there wasn't a place called California anymore back Earthside, he mused. The succulent aromatic fillets came from a big, fat, meaty, dog-like creature that had rushed at them hours before. When it came fast out of some big-leafed rustling bushes, they first noticed the curved yellow horns it carried on a broad, bony head, then the bared teeth. It snarled and leapt with an expression Cliff thought looked as greedy as a weasel in a henhouse. Most of them froze, for it was a true surprise. Not even Quirt and the Sills had seen it coming. But Abe had caught it in midair with a laser shot that drilled through its surprisingly large brain cage, and the thing fell limp and sprawling at their feet. It died with a shudder and a long, gut-deep gasp. They ate the dark, rich meat eagerly. It had a strong, muscular frame that gutted easily. The Sill cracked its bones and sucked out the marrow. Cliff considered doing it. Fat hunger, but the rank, oily smell put him off. So he offered his bone around. "Sure," Abe said, taking it. He sliced a line in it with his serrated blade and snapped the bone open over his knee. "Yum." Irma and Terry shook their heads, no.
"Ugh,"
Terry said.
I grew up on a low-fat diet. That was gospel for a half century, before we had nano-blood policing.
Me too, Irma added, wrinkling her nose. Our generation hated that fat smell.
I like it plenty,
Abby said.
Must be. Hey, what generation are you?
Terry, Cliff, and Irma looked at each other.
We're in our 70s, Irma said.
Gee, I'm 44,
Abby said.
Just a kid,
Terry said.
Surprised you made the grade. The rumor around Fleet was nobody has enough experience before they're in their 50s.
Abby smirked.
You old guys always say that.
Irma chuckled.
The first 40 years are for sex and reproduction. You used yours amassing a lot of tech abilities?
Sure did,
Abby shrugged.
I wanted more than anything to get on a starship. Reproduction is overrated.
They all laughed.
Women routinely stored eggs, and you guys are never quite out of business, Irma said. Childbirth's just easier below 60.
How old do you think Red Wing is?
Terry asked, finishing a slab of meat he had traded with Abby in return for another bone.
Gotta be 100,
Terry said.
Older, I'd say. Went through the tail end of the Age of Appetite, he told me once. Pretty nasty time.
He's a pretty nasty guy,
Abby said, and then sucked loudly on a long bone until they could hear him drawing air all the way through it, a hollow slurp.
Look, Cliff said mildly, plenty of people lived well over 150 now. Red Wing's not what I'd call old.
By now, you mean when we were Earthside, right?
Terry said.
God knows how old people live there now.
That made everyone think of the abyss of time separating them from everyone they knew, Cliff saw. He let that ride for a while. Quirt nodded to him, seeming to understand. Then it was time to move on. They hiked away from their latest rough stone shelter into a clearing sky. There were local horizons here, but now the stray clouds skated over those near horizons, and the sweet blue air above cleared further.
Cliff had not seen before this sharp, sure atmosphere that he knew was deeper than anything on Earth.
Yet now few clouds intruded into his shimmering, sharp air. The piercing point of the bowl's governing sky still hung above them, of course. But he and his team had moved along the slope of the bowl for many days at high speeds, one way or the other, and now the star, Cliff had named it Wickram Singh Star, he recalled, shone not at the absolute center of this sky, but at a slight angle. Its jet seemed now to plunge more deeply toward them. Its streamers turned with elegant grace, pale orange filaments laced across the gauzy firmament. He watched its slow swirls as they slogged across a broad hill. The humans hung back from the Sill advance point men, though some of their Sill party had finally realized were women. He still could not tell their sexes apart with assurance. The Sill didn't seem to have strong binary distinctions between sexes in looks, dress, or behavior. Their occasional puzzled glances at Irma might come from that. Maybe, Cliff realized, humans were just more sexually restless than these Sill. Shapes darted around in the forest. Cliff had seen that with constant sunlight, creatures had to be on guard all the time. Prey had eyes that looked broadly, like rabbits' bulging eyes or insects' compound eyes, all designed to see at wide angles. Predators, as on Earth, had good depth of field, with eyes looking mostly forward, and wide-spaced for maximal 3D perception. Irma walked beside him, shouldering her pack where it wore on her, and said brightly,
"Ever think how come we're seeing so many bipeds?"
Cliff tried to remember that he actually was a biologist.
Hadn't thought. But look, as I recall from lectures anyway, Earthside bipedalism was really nothing more than an oddball vertebrate artifact.
She adjusted her hat against the sunlight.
Those back there, the Kahala, they couldn't pass for us, not even in a dim room. Humanoids, though, for sure. Same basic design. But they're from a tide-locked world, not like Earth at all. Odd.
He kept watching the forest slipping by as they marched on. But theory was fun, too. He bit off a bit of a sweet root they'd pried up from the ground under Quirt's instruction, and said,
"Convergent evolution, must be. Those Kahala probably had four-limbed ancestors just like us. Back Earthside, the arthropods always had limbs to spare, but not poor old mammals like us. We're bipeds because we started with four limbs and developed climbing skills, then tool use. That left two limbs for walking, so that pressure forced us to stand up."
Irma took some of the sweet root, ate through all the rest of it, and smiled. She, too, endlessly scanned the passing trees and vines and searched the skies. You learn to stay alert after so long in the field.
Yeah, Earthside bipeds are really rare. Except for birds, who've got them because they invest so much in wings. For invertebrates, the closest thing to that vertical posture is something like a praying mantis.
Cliff thought on that as he slapped a fat bug that wanted to use his hair for a nest. A mantis has four legs. Irma's voice always went up in pitch when she had an idea.
You're skipping my point. We saw one biped far back, right? Big lumbering thing that ignored us, don't know why. Then the sill. Now these Kahala. All had heads with faces, two forward-looking eyes, and jaws and a nose.
Cliff saw her point. Not a necessary arrangement, right? Just look at arthropod faces. Scary, because they're just close enough to ours to look threatening. Horrible.
Those Kahala, though, had pointy faces. Eyes more on the side.
That's a prey signature, I remember from high school. Eyes front, likes to hunt. Eyes on side, likes to hide. Seems to be a universal.
Plus they had fur, Irma said. We don't because we overheated when we ran long distances. So we lost the fur.
Cliff nodded, recalling how lumbering those Kahala figures had been. Bulky, ponderous, more like bears than people, and not a word had been spoken between them and the humans and Syl. Just glowers and postures, like the signals animals gave. Okay, so the Kahala aren't runners, or talkers. Irma said, voice rising more,
The bowl is telling us that smart aliens converge to a humanoid form.
Cliff thought on that, never ceasing his scan of the forest around them. Or it could be somebody designed them. Quirt was ahead of them and now turned.
Not the folk. Not like your word, humanoid. We say Syl shape. Same thing.
Yeah, Irma said. I wonder why.
Come from self-design for folk,
Quirt said.
Ancient.
So they have, what, two arms and four legs? Cliff asked.
Some do, many others two legs, still all folk.
Irma asked.
The folk, do they really run things here?
Quirt gave a downward eye gesture, which Cliff now knew expressed polite doubt.
Ice mines. They above folk.
How's that work? Cliff pressed.
That changes now, since you came. We still work for ice mines, too, now.
Quirt brandished his small communicator, a pyramidal solid that could deform into a flat screen. Cliff had yet to figure out how that worked.
Irma said, What do you do for them?
Brought you to them.
That's it?
Irma asked.
Why us?
You disturb. Folk call you late invader because you knew. Ice mines want to see you, know you, so we bring.
We're just a small ship passing by, Irma said.
Something about glory I hear from ice mines. They want to know what you are going to glory.
Quirt gave a head shrug.
Not sure what glory be.
It's a star right ahead of you, Cliff said. We can't see it. Your star is too bright.
Star ahead?
Quirt's face went blank, which meant the alien was thinking, giving nothing away. Irma said,
It's a star a lot like yours, still so far away that it's only a dot. Its planet has a biosphere with oxygen and nitrogen and the usual. We want to go there, live there.
Quirt kept the blank look, but the eyes jittered up, down, around. The alien was undergoing an entire conceptual shift. Suddenly Cliff saw it. The sill had been ushered into the view from the bowl hull, the deep dark abyss of glinting stars only lately. The ice mines had beckoned to them somehow, sent signals, and propelled forward the events Cliff's team had then intersected. So Quirt and the others had never seen the stars at all until they brought Cliff's team through the underground labyrinth, and to where they could see the sliding panorama of the galaxy in full. The Syl had been like people trapped in a cave, never shown the sky. Their world, the world of all who lived on the bowl, was an endless, warm paradise in steady daylight. Their sun and jet obliterated perspective. The ordinary denizens never saw the stars, or the great plain of the galaxy hanging in a black firmament, dark and strange, and sprinkled with twinkling jewel stars.
That revelation had come to the Sill when they were restless and angry. The folk had suppressed them for ageless times, but now they knew where they were, who they were.
All that had exploded into their world only lately. Cliff's team had confirmed new truths, and so had made many tragedies come to pass.
The battle with the Skyfish, the bombing and firestorms of the Sill cities, so much else.
Cliff started to say some of this to Quirt.
The alien still had the stiff, fixed face, giving nothing away while it thought. But then movements caught their attention. The Point Sill stopped, gestured, and muttered something in a low whisper. Head and arm gestures. Something ahead, spread out. They all followed their standard tactic, moving off to both sides and seeking cover, then moving carefully forward. The humans had learned this in training, fire and maneuver. Each member of the Sill and human team moved only when others could cover with fire from lasers, arm arrows. Ahead, a faint repeating clatter came through the trees and vines. Beyond, the land cleared. Cautiously, they worked their way to a vantage point on a small hill. A strip of neatly arranged, emerald-green agricultural fields stretched into the distance to their left and right. Simple farm machinery worked in them, making whack, whack, whack noises. Directly ahead, the forest resumed several kilometers away. The crop was yellow and purple shoots that seemed to spray out like arrows from a thick brown trunk. These were 3 or 4 meters tall, Cliff judged, like trees with spokes flying out. The spokes were fat and had wide, fan-like flowers along their lengths.
The air carried a fine mist of... what? Pollen?
We can cross that at a run, A.B. said.
Quirt pointed to figures working in the field.
They had trucks and a robot harvester that worked away, chopping off the shoots and dropping them into the trucks. The machinery worked with a regular whoom, whoom, whoom. A breeze brought a heady, sweet scent like orange blossoms with a cutting undertang. Everything moved with a slow rhythm, and the scene reminded Cliff of a monotonous summer he had spent on a farm in California's Central Valley. He close-upped them and said, "They're the same kind we left behind. Those humanoids mesmerized by that ancient rock life. Kahala."
"These special Kahala evolve for farm work," Quirt said. "They stay here, always on farm, birthing and dying all done here."
Irma asked. "They live in a village all their lives?
Content, in balance."
Quirt conferred with the other Sill in quick, scattershot bursts of unintelligible talk. They all looked wary to Cliff, as nearly as he could judge. The Sill had complex suites of expressions that darted across their faces, mostly coded in their eye moves, and the light-browed ridgelines above. Quirt turned to the humans.
"This A.B. right, run fast across. See there?"
Nearly directly across from them was a complex of low buildings, the tan color of dried mud.
"Their hatchery. Few Kahala there most times. We cross, the Kahala not see."
Cliff tried to take this in. A special form of Kahala just for the grunt labor of farming?
Had the folk specially bred for that? And hatchery? They moved through the cover of a long, winding grove of zigzag trees. He and Irma thought the zigzag strategy was to get more sunlight under a constant sun, which meant more exposed foliage turned to the direction of the star, a reddish dot fixed firmly in the sky. The jet's filmy light they ignored. Bristly branches and coiling vines sprawled along the thick zigzag trunks to harvest the constant sunlight. That made them useful cover, because the branches were thin at the top and thicker at the tree base. Easy to slip among and elude any watching eyes. Warily, they stopped within easy view of the tannin brick buildings. As a Californian, Cliff seldom saw ceramic slabs stacked to great heights. His instinct said they were earthquake vulnerable. But there were no quakes here at all. He saw through binocs furry figures moving with lumbering, swaying bodies on two legs, moving slowly among the brick walls. He pointed to them.
"Friends not,"
Quirt said with narrowed eyes and edgy eye clicks. "These Kahala will turn us over to the folk?" Terry asked.
Quirt said,
"Must,"
and gave a downturned eye move. The other Sill shuffled, and eye clicked in what seemed agreement, their feet shuffling, impatient.
He seemed to feel there was no time to waste in pondering this problem. No point in trying to go around the long farming strip that faded away into the light tan color of the distance, which came from simple dust haze. No telling how long this farm was. An odd way to cultivate. Why not in squared-off plots so you minimize the travel distance?
No time to think much, A.B. said. Ready to run?
They set off at a good pace. The Sil got out in front right away with their long, graceful strides, taking long, slow, deep breaths as their feet came down. They seemed to have evolved for running. Humans had, too, but not this well. Cliff wondered if their homeworld, with somewhat lower gravity, had better shaped them for this part of the bowl. Again, he wondered, as sweat collected in his eyebrows and trickled down, stinging his eyes, what the Sil's agenda was. Getting out from under the folk, yes. But those big birds ran this place, and a few puny humans surely could not make much difference. A puzzle. But without the Sil, they'd have been nabbed by the folk long ago. He let it pass.
They made a good fast run across the fields, running close to the curious trees. The Kahala were upwind of their crossing route, too, so that might be an advantage. Cliff was surprised at how easily he ran. He was in better physical condition now from so long on the run, and the local grav seemed lower here, too. But Quartz had turned, surveying the whole area, as did all the Sil. They were worried. The rough rectangular buildings Quartz called a hatchery loomed up, two stories high and no windows. They entered the complex, panting and sweaty, and made their way down the main corridor between the buildings. There were no Kahala around at all. A few zigzag trees lined this main street of the place, their wood worn and gray. The Sil went down side passages, doing recon, and in a few moments came running back, fast. They shouted a word in Sil language and formed a defensive arc facing two passageways. Automatically, the humans gathered in behind them, drawing weapons, looking anxiously around. Only when a Sil launched one of its arm arrows did they look up. Things like meter-wide spiders came over the lip of the roof. They were white and clacked as they moved, surging down the wall on flexing black palps. Their legs were bristly and black. Big, angry red eyes glared at the sides of a squashed face. The first Sil arm arrow lanced through one that was halfway over the edge of the roof. It scrabbled at the wall and fell with a smack at their feet. The Sil who had nailed it stepped forward, shot at another of the attackers, hit it at dead center of its circular body, then bent and plucked the arrow out, inserting it quickly back in the air sheath. The Sil were shooting at the things now, and the humans used their lasers, but there were plenty of the things, and they kept coming.
They move more like crabs than like spiders, Cliff thought as the Sil fell back.
He aimed at one of the things and hit it, but it just kept climbing down the wall toward them. His shot had gone through it near its edge, but that was not enough, apparently. They made small, shrill, chippering sounds. They moved sideways with quick, sure moves. Now Cliff recalled a relayed message from Beth when they had broken out of their captivity. "Spidos," he said. Irma got the reference.
"Those were huge," they said. "These aren't."
"Local adaptation," A.B. said. "Our lasers blow through them, but don't kill, most of the time."
Five of the things took on a Sil. They crawled up its legs and bit deep with claws. The Sil howled. It batted at them and lurched away. That unnerved the other Sil as rivers of the midget spidos rushed down from other roofs and through the lanes nearby. Their high, shrill cries became a shriek. The humans huddled behind a thin line of Sils who were running out of their arm arrows. Quart was driving arm arrows into the spidos, but then shouted in Sil, and then, in anguish, "Back through!" Cliff turned and saw a Sil had found, down a side corridor, a big frame door that opened. They all turned and rushed there. The spidos' shrill cries rose as they came after the running Sil and humans. Several Sil tore branches off the zigzag trees along the way, snapping them off. They got through the doorway and into a big, high room. The door slammed. Sil secured it. Illumination streamed down from a ceiling that simmered with ivory light. The place reeked of some sullen odor. It was damp and warm here, and the humans looked at each other, eyes wide, still surprised by the sudden ferocity of the Spido attack. The Sil muttered to each other. They were all standing under the heat beating down from above, panting in moist air flavored with an odd stinging taste.
"'We're
Were those spiders?
Abe asked.
More like crabs, Cliff said.
They have a shell and move with a sideways crawl. Lots of legs, Irma said. If there weren't so many, we could just tromp on them, Terry said.
But there are.
Abe was scared and covered it with anger. The sills stirred and murmured, and Court listened to them intently. The humans talked, but no ideas emerged. The high, keening cries of the Spidos came through the walls. They all knew they were trapped, and the shock of it was sinking in, Cliff saw.
Let's see what there is here, what this place is, Cliff said. It was good to get them focused on something beyond their fears. They murmured, shuffled, and started to look around. Around them stood cylindrical towers with big, fat, orange spheres arrayed in a matrix. There were some kind of ceramic tubes laced through the crude, baked brick frame, and those felt warm to the touch.
What are these things? A whole roomful, Irma said.
Court said,
Kahala eggs. Hatch here.
And took two other sill to prowl the room. Cliff followed down the line of Kahala egg cylinder holders. The warm, damp air was cloying. Heads jerked toward a scraping noise. They all saw a white carapace of a Spido scuttling away. It left behind a ripped-open Kahala egg that dripped brown fluids on the red clay floor. The Spido had been eating it. A sill stabbed it with a shaft of wood it had yanked off a zigzag tree outside. The Spido writhed, worked its claws against the shaft, and died with a faint, squealing gasp. They found another a few moments later. Some had gotten in here, Cliff supposed, and were eating Kahala eggs.
Food source, Irma said.
Several of the big orange spheres were already spattered over the ceramic floor, their insides gone. Cliff followed, still dazed by the speed of events. He shook his head, rattled. As the sill searched the aisles of egg-holding cylinders, Cliff kept up, feeling pretty useless, and then asked Quirt,
The Kahala look kind of like us, two legs, same body shape, but they lay eggs?
Kahala way, Quirt said.
Its eyes were wary, searching the whole room.
Stack their eggs here. Let hatch, safe, so they can work their fields.
But the Spidos, that's what we call them, they come and eat?
An eye click of agreement.
Been so long time. We call those things Upanafiki. Pests are.
They're smart enough to get into these hatcheries. Court sniffed and gave soft barking sounds with a head jerk, which seemed to be the sill equivalent of laughter. All the sill joined in. Some alien inside joke, Cliff suspected.
Or was sill humor a category outside human comprehension?
Court stopped the quiet barking laugh and said,
Kahala not smart.
Egg layers. Cliff tried to get his head around all this. Irma said,
Earthside, we have monotremes, mammal egg layers. They're very odd. Triassic, maybe.
Cliff shook his head. Forget about parallels to Earth. So, smart egg layers who are humanoid tool users.
What the hell? With evolution on the bull, all bets are off.
Court said,
Upanafiki many. Kahala crave land. Upanafiki keep Kahala numbers down. Kahala and Upanafiki.
Court thrust its bony hands together.
Always fight. Dance.
Abe said, Where did these Kahala come from? What world? Court said,
Kahala means in your tongue, one face folk.
Terry got it.
So they came from a planet tidally locked to its star? On their side, it was always sunny. They had an adaptation advantage when they arrived at the bowl, over people like us who need night. Makes sense.
Court gave an eye click of agreement.
Spread widely. They are conservative. Folk use them. Not good allies for us.
Cliff frowned. Evolutionary theory in the middle of a fight.
Come see this,
Irma called. She was at the other end of the room. They followed her up some crudely fashioned stairs of gray clay ceramic. The dusty second floor was like the first, but Irma pointed to a hole in its ceiling.
Looks like they dug down through.
Cliff crouched, jumped, and caught the edge of the hole. Some of it crumbled away, but he held on and pulled his head through the meter-wide opening. This might be risky, but he was curious, and hanging there, he saw the roof now deserted. A nearby piece of wood caught his eye. He held on with one hand and shuffled a slim shaft nearby into the hole, letting it drop. Then he followed it, landing neatly. Low grav had its uses. Irma picked up the slender piece of wood.
It has a tip like flint. Those small spidos, they're tool users.
Keep Kahala stable, Quirt said, glancing upward. They outside on ground. We go this way.
Cliff and Irma looked askance at the alien. Quirt went to the stairwell and shouted orders in the slippery Sill's speech. Terry and Abby came up with them.
Those spidos, Terry said. They're chipping at the door with something.
Irma needed help, but in surprisingly short order, their entire team, humans and Sill alike, made the leap to the ceiling hole. Those already on the roof grabbed their hands and hauled them out onto the flat roof. It was made of tan triangular bricks. Now Cliff could see Quirt's plan. The hatchery buildings were close together, and the Sill could leap from one roof to the next. So could the humans. The Sill were remarkably calm. They had met this foe before. They started leaping across. Cliff looked down as he took a running jump across. The spidos were clustered around the door to the building they had just left. Several of them held bigger wood shafts, also with blackened hard tips that seemed to have been turned on a fire. Irma came next. She landed with one foot halfway onto the next roof lip. Cliff grabbed her and tugged her in. Terry and Abby followed. By that time, most of the Sill were across to the next building, looking unhurried but quick. They all ran and leaped, ran and leaped, and soon were at the far end of the hatchery buildings. There the Sill slung a thin wire around nearby trees, throwing it with a kind of boomerang hook that wrapped around a tree trunk. Then a Sill attached the wire to its backpack solar panel source, made some adjustments, hit a command switch, and the wire expanded, puffing up into a thick rope that hands could grab. Cliff blinked, a useful trick he had never seen. They descended on that rope, belaying a bit to break their sliding descent. Cliff and Irma leaned over the side of the building to glimpse the spidos, while others took the rope down. Spidos were still working on the door, chipping with crude spikes. But then some Kahala came in from a side corridor, shouting. The spidos turned, and a battle began. The spidos' bristly palps moved in a jerky blur. The Kahala had simple hoes or similar farm tools. They struck down hard on the spidos and pinned them. But there were a lot, and some Kahala got overwhelmed. This was nature, red in tooth and claw in a way he'd never seen. There were over 100 spidos and maybe a dozen Kahala. A melee. As they watched, Irma said, "A fight over reproduction? Nasty." Quirt had come over to them and looked down, unsurprised.
Folk set rules. Keep Kahala from farming more and more. Use Upanafiki to keep not many Kahala eggs to hatch. These Upanafiki pests for us. Their war with Kahala never end.
The folk don't stop this? Irma asked.
Folk want this.
Quirt paused, searching for the right English words.
Equilibrium. Stasis.
As Cliff watched five spidos swarm fast over a struggling Kahala humanoid, he thought, nightmare spiders on a caffeine high. The Kahala toppled and vanished beneath the swarming spidos. He recalled a remark heard long ago. Flattery isn't the highest compliment. Parasitism is.
Damn!
Irma's shrill shout jerked him out of his thoughts. He saw several spidos, their legs grappling for purchase over the lip of the roof 20 meters away. They had come up the wall. They made a sharp hissing, their legs clicking with darting moves. He and Irma had been distracted, and now with Quirt were the only ones left on the roof. Quirt was already ahead of them and took the rope with an easy grace. Down Quirt slid, shouting back, "Come fast!" Irma went next, and Cliff turned to take a laser shot at the mass of spidos surging across the tan brick roof. The bolts punched holes easily enough, but the spidos did not stop. A bolt to the center did work, and one of the things flopped down, but now they were 5 meters away. Cliff leaned down and plucked the securing anchor of the rope. No time to slide down it now. He couldn't be sure the spidos couldn't use it. The black rope was firmly fixed in the trees 30 meters away,
so he just grabbed it and ran off the edge of the roof. He dropped, then swung. His breath rasped as he ignored a snap in his shoulder. He tumbled on the descent and tried to pull himself up the rope as it carried him toward the trees. His swing brought him boot forward, so when he hit the branches of a zigzag tree, the leaves lashed him. One limb caught him smack in the face. He hit another, and a sharp pain lanced into his ribs. He gasped and slid down the rope, a nearly vertical drop now. The zigzag tree trunk smacked his thigh, but he managed to get his boots under him. He sprawled when he hit. As he was rolling away, his ribs sent him a lance of pain, and his vision blurred for a moment. He lay there gasping, and hands grabbed him. They heaved him up, and Terry shouted, "Gotta run!" So he did. Not very well. The spiders were running through the trees already, lots of them. Their chippering calls were loud now. But the spiders were small, and if humans were good at anything, he thought, it was sure as hell good old running. For a while, though, until they no longer saw the spiders behind them, it was more like limping for him. He was worn out.